You are now part of a social experiment.
Welcome to Mastermind, the show where you learn to develop and master your skill from the best of the best. Here's your host, Mr. G.
Thank you for joining us today on the journey towards self-mastery. Our next guest is a formerly homeless returning citizen and now president and executive director of the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition. He's a graduate of Florida International University College of Law. He is known for his work with voting and criminal justice issues. His activism led to the passing of Amendment 4, which restored the voting rights for 1.4 million Floridians with past felony convictions, which was the biggest expansion of voting rights in half a century. Governor DeSantis placed limitations on Amendment 4, but he organized people across the United States like John Legend, Michael Vick, Rihanna, Michael Jordan, Ariana Grande, the Miami Dolphins, the Miami Heat, and the Orlando Magic to donate over $27 million that was able to pay the fines and fees of 40,000 returning citizens and able to register over 87,000 and counting to vote. He has been honored as Floridian and Central Floridian of the Year and has been recognized by Time Magazine as one of the top 100 most influential people in the world. He has presented in front of the United Nations, President Barack Obama's staff, and more. He's appeared on numerous shows such as Al Jazeera, Democracy Now!, MSNBC with Joy Reid, Fox News with Dana Perino and Tucker Carlson, Samantha Bee, All In with Chris Hayes, and The Breakfast Club. He was recently awarded the MacArthur Award Genius Grant for his work with felony disenfranchisement. Let's welcome today Mr. Desmond Meade to the program. Mr. Meade, how you doing today, sir?
Yo, what's up, my brother? Thank you so much for that introduction. I'm looking around saying, man, who are you talking about? that was a mouthful there.
Yes, sir. Well deserved, man. Well deserved. And you've done quite the work, I think, just, you know, in Florida. And, you know, before we get to your life, I definitely want to get into just a bit of information for those of us that don't know kind of what's going on within the legal systems of Florida. But definitely an honor to be speaking with you and just taking time out, you know, to talk with us on the program. I know, like, for people listening in, they might not be aware of some of the terminology you use. You say returning citizens. So what does returning citizens exactly mean? And why do you use that phrase? Just for those that might not know.
When I use the word returning citizen, it is in reference to people who have been previously convicted of a felony offense. Some served time in prison, some did not. Mm-hmm. But just for the mere fact that they have a felony conviction, you know, we refer to them that way. It's an attempt really to get away from using the words felon, convict, ex-con, ex-felon, criminal, you know, all of these derogatory words that really does no good, right? It doesn't, I mean, at the end of the day, these type of words and research has shown actually increase the likelihood of people recidivating or committing more offenses. You know, we've heard the adage that if you call a child stupid growing up, they're going to grow up believing that they're stupid.
That's true.
And so we try to create positive words, and, you know, other organizations throughout the country use terms such as justice impacted, you know, individuals, formerly incarcerated individuals. But at the end of the day, man, you know, they're all people. And I think that that's what we really ultimately want to lead with, is that their humanity, not their charge and not their past, but who they are today.
Yeah, I think that makes a ton of sense to use that. I might use that myself, man. I might have to steal that, returning citizens. Okay, so some of us might not be privy to, like, the legal system and the way it functions in Florida. I know you're based in Florida, and you had a piece where you wrote about, you know, the incident that occurred with Trayvon Martin, and you highlighted just a ton of issues that plague the Florida justice system and black and brown folks. So I wanted to just get an introductory information to just the Florida legal system based on that piece that you talked about, and some of the things going on in Florida that we might not know about.
Yes. You know, so generally, you know, the legal system in Florida is basically the same as legal systems in many other states. But, you know, matter of fact, I've renamed Florida into Flaw-rida, right? There's so many flaws, you know, and Florida is a place where you've seen stand your ground laws, right? And where seeing the Trayvon Martins being murdered, you know, for walking home with a hoodie on, you know, and talking back to a wannabe security officer. Florida, the place where you see a Brian Jordan get murdered, right? Because he played his music too loud. Right. You know, Florida is the place of the hanging Chad. Florida is a place where you've seen thousands of people get removed from the roster, voting roster, because of alleged previous felony conviction. And so we're like almost, it seems as if we're like a testing ground where folks are saying, okay, what can we get away with in Florida? And if we can get away with it in Florida, we can get away with it, you know, in other states throughout the country. You know, at the end of the day, though, you know, when you talk about the criminal legal system, it's very unforgiving in Florida. You know, once a person is convicted of a felony offense, they lose the right to vote, then their civil rights for the rest of their lives, right to serve on a jury, which played a role in Trayvon Martin's trial. Well, not his trial, but George Zimmerman's trial for the murder of Trayvon Martin, because you know, the people who was on the jury was basically majority white women, right? And the jury actually reflected the voting demographics of the county in which that trial was held, right? And so being able to not serve on a jury and not run for office, other handicaps that we're given for just because we have a felony conviction. And then, of course, Florida was one of the worst states in establishing what we call a felony threshold bill. And what that is basically is where individuals, if you say, for instance, was caught shoplifting, in some states, you would have to actually steal something that had a value of over $1,200 before that charge could become a felony. In Florida, it was $300.
And wow, so, I didn't know that.
I mean, cell phones, you're not going to find a cell phone that costs less than $300 or valued less than $300 nowadays. And so for, you know, we had a gentleman in the military. Well, he was in the military. He served overseas and in the Iraqi war. And he came home and was struggling. And he went grocery shopping and wrote a bad check. Right. And, you know, the bad check was for a little bit more than $300. Guess what? This veteran lost his right to vote for the rest of his life.
Wow.
You know, we seen in Florida where people were losing their right to vote. I mean, for driving with a suspended license, burning a tire in public. If you release helium filled balloons in the air. Now, you know, we all go to these memorial services with the white balloons and we release them in the air, or maybe we were celebrating somebody's graduation or birthday and the balloons get released in the air, or anniversary. Guess what? In Florida, you know, you can actually get prosecuted for that.
Wow.
And that's a third degree felony, and you will lose the right to vote for the rest of your life. And it actually, let me tell you, we had a case where a guy, on Valentine's Day, rather than giving his girl a dozen roses, he decided to release 12 red balloons in the air, you know, in honor of his love for this woman. And a law enforcement officer seen him release those balloons and promptly arrested him. You know?
Wow.
So, I mean, it's so easy. And Florida has been one of those states. And you see that a lot in southern states, because if you trace it back, the history of this stuff, all the way back to the Reconstruction era, and you see that once, you know, the slaves were freed, and they had just as much right as anyone else, and they started exercising those rights and started getting elected into office, the response was to find creative ways to diminish the political capital of the newly freed slaves. And so you had the Jim Crow laws that required people pay poll tax, that required people take literacy tests, and then felon disenfranchisement laws, and where what they were doing was creating laws, right, that they figured that it was more likely that a slave would commit, and then use the violation of those laws as a pretext for stripping the right to vote from the newly freed slaves. And so in Alabama, you know, a man would lose the right to vote for hitting his wife, but he wouldn't lose it for killing his wife, right? And so we've seen how these laws were created in such a way as to minimize a minority's ability to participate in this political process. And, you know, all the way up to the day, you know, we see instances of it and we see the role that it plays. Matter of fact, in Ferguson, what we saw was so many people were intimidated into even going to vote because the police was patrolling polling locations looking for people who had so-called outstanding warrants, right? Wow. And so that's the same thing that we've seen during the Reconstruction era. We've seen it today. And then a lot of these laws that are now felonies, I mean, at the end of the day, they shouldn't even be on the books, but they're there. And it's being used as a way to really quiet the poor, quiet the marginalized, you know, and keep them out of the game and on the sidelines.
Man, thank you for that, man. I didn't even know some of that stuff, man. The balloons, wow. Can't imagine, man. One of the things that stood out too in your article, you mentioned that out of 77 juveniles serving life sentences in Florida, 76 of them are African American. I thought that was fascinating, man.
Yeah, that was. Let me tell you, for quite some time, Florida led the nation, right, in direct filing juveniles, and direct filing means that you take a minor and you would charge him as an adult, right. Mm-hmm. And so Florida led the nation in doing that, you know, and then of course also giving juveniles life sentences. And so, I mean, like I said, this state is a state that really doubles down on some very oppressive policies. And you're seeing what's happening even within the last few months, you know, that they're not stopping. So Florida is doing what it does best, and that is really oppresses people.
And appreciate that insight, man. I think a lot of us, we kind of have an idea about Florida, you know, with Governor DeSantis. He's always on the news for something crazy. But, you know, sometimes we don't know some of those, the background and some of the things that people get arrested for and stays on their record and the convictions and how it affects minors. So appreciate that information. Before we get into the amazing work that you've done, kind of battling a lot of some of the issues happening in Florida, as it relates to definitely felons, or the formerly incarcerated, or like you would like to call, returning citizens. I would like to just get an idea of a little bit of your history growing up and some of the things that led you to where you are today. Cause I think, you have a very interesting story, man. It kind of reminds me of, when people say like, yo, I'm really not supposed to be here, man. Like some of the things I read about in your book, I'm just fascinated of your journey and how you got to where you are. So if you could just start with us from your childhood, man, and just growing up and everything.
You know, yeah, I'm one of the person that will quickly tell you I'm really not supposed to be here, man. You know, but I was born in the U.S. Virgin Islands, and I moved over to the continental United States at a very young age, and spent most of my younger years in South Florida. Specifically the 305 Miami-Dade County, halfway through my middle school years, I end up moving to a suburb of Chicago, a place called Aurora, Illinois, with my dad, and spent some time there and started just moving back and forth between Chicago and Miami. But after graduating high school, I eventually, you know, joined the military, did some time there, and I ended up getting discharged, dishonorably discharged from the military because I was court-martialed for stealing. And, you know, I had developed a drug addiction.
This stemmed from the military?
While I was in the military, I developed a drug addiction, and you know, my abuse of drugs led me down some very dark pathways.
Right. I just wanted to highlight that before you continue with your story. So you started using in the military. What was that initial experience?
I got addicted while I was in the military.
Okay.
That was not the first time I used drugs. I used drugs, you know, when I was in high school. You know, we smoked a little weed, you know.
And, gotcha.
But it was that, you know, now and then thing. It wasn't until I was in the military for a few years that really started using drugs heavily and became addicted to it. And my addiction, you know, like I said, led me to do some not pleasant things that eventually got me court-martialed. And so I did some time in the, you know, U.S. disciplinary barracks of Fort Leavenworth. And after completing my sentence, I moved back home to South Florida and to move on with my life. I started engaging in executive protection, which was kind of cool. But I still had that drug addiction, right? And eventually that drug addiction led me to being homeless, led me to being arrested several times in and out of the local jails. And eventually,
and what drugs were we talking about? Like, what were you using?
Oh, man, let me tell you. So this is that progression. Started out with marijuana and mm-hmm. graduated from marijuana to cocaine and graduated from cocaine to crack. So eventually, that was crack was my dominant drug of choice. And like I said, it really led me to being homeless. And eventually I was arrested and convicted of a charge, possession of a firearm by a convicted felon. And I was sentenced to 15 years, but.
Right. I know in your book, you mentioned with that charge, like it wasn't even your gun.
Yeah.
Right? So
that was being in the wrong place at the wrong time. And, at the end of the day, having the wrong jury. it was an experience. You know, there was a time when I was, bitter about that, and I think it helped sustain my drug abuse for a while. But in my recovery, man, what I've learned was that, even today, I look back at those moments as, just things that I had to go through to prepare me to be who I am today. The trials and the tribulations and, they say that people who are closest to the pain are more often those that are closest to the solution. And that, until you walk a mile or two in a man's shoes, it's hard to really understand what it is that he's going through. And so, I look at the experiences that I've had with homelessness, with drug addiction, with incarceration. All right, and those are three major pieces that impact so many folks that I know, so many folks in this country. And to be able to now speak on those things, my experience actually legitimizes and give me, I guess more power, more authority to really voice my thoughts and opinions because I've been through those things. It's right. Not just something I read about or studied in school,
Right. I wanted to highlight just a few things just from your own unique experience, too, with the homelessness and the drug use. As far as the homelessness goes, like some people might say, like, well, you were homeless for 11 years. And people might be like, well, why didn't you go to a family member's house or stay with somebody? Like, did you have people in your circle that you could have went to? Or did you make the decision just not to use those parameters?
Well, let me say this. When you're talking about homelessness, even if you go, say, with a family member, you're still considered homeless, right? Mm. You're homeless if you don't have a roof over your head that you pay the bills, right? If it's somebody else's house that you're laying out, you're still homeless, right? And so, yeah, I've had opportunities. I think it's one thing to be homeless. It's another thing to be homeless with a substance abuse issue, right? And, I had that. I was a crack addict. And so as a result, I'm not going to be able to just lay up in somebody's house, I might end up, stealing some stuff from them so I can go get high, and people are not going to want to trust me. If I'm, in active addiction. And so I didn't, try to force that issue. I just adapted to my surroundings. And, for the most part, I was living or sleeping in abandoned buildings. I've slept behind dipsy dumpsters, you know, and eventually I end up sleeping on a bus bench. You know, maybe I think it was the night before, you know, I had my transformative experience.
Right. Part of that experience too was that night that you contemplated, you know, ending it all. So can you walk us through that day and kind of like what made you make the decision not to do it and to continue the journey through your life?
Well, I don't know if I made the decision. I think it was more of the decision was made for me, right? Because, you know, like I said, the night before I slept on the bus bench. And I remember sleeping on that bus bench because earlier in the evening, you know, I went, a friend of mine advised me to seek prayer from a particular pastor at a particular church. And when I went there, you know, and I sat through the service and after the service approaching the pastor and asking the pastor for prayer, you know, and I was very, explicit. And I was like, listen, I'm not asking for money. I'm not asking for food. I'm not asking for clothes. All I'm asking for is prayer. Cause someone told me that if you can pray for me, that my life will improve. And that pastor actually told me to make an appointment for the next day. And, you know, in my head, I was like, wow, all I wanted was prayer. I was like, don't you know how desperate I am? I spent my last bit of change to come here with the hope that somebody, a person of God was going to lay hands on me and that was going to improve my life, you know? And, you know, I end up walking out that church. I never made the appointment. I end up walking out that church and thinking how even God has turned his back on me. And so that was it for me, you know, and I didn't care anymore. And that's why that night I spent the night sleeping on the bus bench because I didn't care who saw me. You know, in the past, I would sleep behind a dumpster in an abandoned building. I wouldn't sleep somewhere the way anybody just driving by would see, hey, look at that. Isn't that Desmond? You know, nah, man, I wasn't going out like that. You know, I had at least, I think, a little bit of pride, ounce of pride or something. But that night, I didn't care anymore, you know, because even God had turned his back on me. And when I woke up the next day, I tried to get help from a treatment facility, and it was weird because in order to get into the drug program, they make you take a urinalysis. And if you have drugs in your system, they won't let you in the program. I'm like, if I could stay clean, I wouldn't need your program.
Exactly.
You know, but after I got turned down there, I was walking. And as I was approaching railroad tracks, my mind started to think about, you know, a story I had read maybe a few weeks earlier about a gentleman that who committed suicide by jumping in front of a train. And so when I got to these train tracks, I stopped, could not cross these train tracks. I was just fixated, right, with this story. And here I am standing there thinking, man, what is this going to feel like? You know, am I going to die instantly or do I have to go through moments of agonizing pain? How is it going to feel to have those steel wheels just crush my body and sever my body into three pieces or whatever? They're going to crush my skull. I have to make sure that I jump right so that my skull don't get crushed. Does it matter? I mean, all of these things was going through my mind. And mind you, I was standing at the railroad tracks of one of the busiest tracks in Dade County. These are tracks that lead to the Port of Miami and the Fruit District and the Garment District. So historically, there have been trains going, passing this cross section constantly, you know, maybe 2-3 times on the hour. And I mean, I stood there and I waited and no train came. And so eventually I did cross the tracks. And so I think that, you know, by the grace of God, to be honest with you, I think that something happened that where that train did not come. Because if it would have came, you know, more than likely I would have been jumping in front of that train. Because I didn't see any light at the end of the tunnel. I didn't have any more self-esteem, no more pride. It was all gone. And I was ready to check out. I really was. There was nothing left.
Man, I'm so glad you didn't, man, because you've done so many wonderful things.
Well, I'm glad I didn't.
Yeah, man, that's wow. It's just such an inspiring story, you know, just to be in one place and then in a completely other place, you know, years later. And I think that that is definitely a great story for people that think that, you know, they should end their lives. And you never know, like, what, you know, life is going to bring you years and years down the line, man. I'm sure you didn't know that you were going to do so many amazing things going forward.
Brother, let me tell you, man, and then I tell somebody this. I tell folks this all the time, you know. When I was standing in front of railroad tracks, if somebody would have came up to me and said, Desmond, don't jump in front of that train, because in a few years you're going to sit on boards with commissioners and all these elected officials, or you're going to meet the president not once but a couple of times, that you're going to lead an organization to restore voting rights to 1.4 million, and you're going to be time 100, and you're going to be a MacArthur Genius Grant. If somebody would have told me that back then, the first thing I would have asked them was where they get that good dope they smoking. Let me get some of that tension, right? Because at the end of the day, standing there as a crack addict, as a homeless person with a record a mile long, there was no way you could have convinced me that in a matter of a few years that I would have been able to accomplish those things. I mean, at that time, to me, it would have seemed impossible, you know. But I tell folks that, hey, I'm standing here right now today as a living testimony that no matter what obstacles a person may face, no matter what they may have done in the past, right, that there is still an opportunity, right, to do amazing things, to impact our communities, to make a difference in this world, to make a difference in our communities. And to be one of the 100 most influential in the world. I mean, if I could do it, anyone can do it, you know, and there is a testament to that, and that, you know, we don't remove the word impossible from our vocabulary. What we do is that we repurpose the word impossible, and we repurpose it into I'm possible, right? Mm-hmm. Because anything is possible, for a person that has a high power that they trust in. And that they, you know, make a commitment to really giving back and to engaging in acts or engaging in activities that's being motivated by love for others.
Agreed. I think another one of the things that you've done is you've challenged the way that people look at people that have been addicted to drugs and that have been homeless. And you said it's kind of, your experience has kind of redefined the way that you look at it as well. So how do you look at the formerly incarcerated now and then homeless folks and people that are addicted to drugs? How do you look at it now? And how do you think society should be looking at these folks? Because, you know, I don't personally think that we should be looking at people that are addicted to substances as criminals, man. I don't know if you would agree with that.
I look at them as the next possible superstar, right? I really do. It's vitally important that we do not lose sight of the humanity in the individual, no matter what situation they're in. I remember seeing crackheads on the street, you know, when I wasn't using it. I remember and how we treated them and talked about them. I mean, we got all kinds of jokes about it, right? I mean, Dave Chappelle got a character.
Yes, sir.
You know, I mean, and you know, we joke about it and we look down on them and we actually dehumanize them, right? Mm-hmm. When in reality, man, they're still a human being. They're somebody's son, brother, sister, daughter, mother, father, that's there. Same as individual who's incarcerated, right? That just because they're incarcerated, that don't diminish their humanity. But unfortunately, right, we have been conditioned to act that way, and figure, well, since that person is been convicted, or since that person is addicted, they're not as human as we are. They're not as deserving as we are, right? And we lose sight of the fact that they are we. They are we. You know, I tell a story about, you know, this book I read, African Americans and the Atomic Bomb, by a good friend of mine, Dr. Vincent Ntandi. And that book was written as, you know, to really talk about the African Americans' response to the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And a point in that book that really had grabbed my attention was how the United States had to engage in a massive propaganda campaign prior to dropping the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Mm-hmm. How they made Japanese people to be evil, violent folks. They exaggerated cartoon characters. You know, the slanting of the eyes, the sharpening of the teeth, you know, where they're looking like fangs and, you know, basically driving a narrative that these folks are coming to invade our country and they're going to burn our villages down. Mm. And what they were able to do was actually kill two birds with one stone with that propaganda campaign. They were able to dehumanize the Japanese people. While dehumanizing them, desensitize us as to their humanity.
Right. Right.
And they did such a great job, man, that when the United States dropped the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki and killed thousands of innocent children, women, and men, rather than there be a moral outrage, there was a celebration in the streets.
Mm.
Right? There was, just think about it, that we were actually celebrating the murder of innocent women, children, and men. All right. And that's the power of a narrative. And that is the same type of narrative that's being used that depict, you know, people like me as dangerous, super predators and criminals. I mean, let me back up for a minute. When you even think about immigration, you know, when you think of an immigrant, it's one way, but the minute they add one word to it, right, and they say illegal immigrant, mm-hmm. right, then people are not as sympathetic to them, you know. They're not as concerned about them, you know, as it would if it was just an immigrant. And the only difference basically is just the adding of one word, right? And that adding of that one word, illegal, shifts the entire narrative now, right? And so when you talk about the criminals, you know, we have to do something to these criminals. It creates this illusion that allows us to not care about the fact that we're actually putting human beings in cages that's not even designed for animals, right? That we're taking kids, children, right, and putting them behind bars and putting them in solitary confinement the way they have little to no interaction with another human being. That is not normal stuff, man, you know? And when they come up with these three strikes and you're out laws or the stand your ground laws, and people are actually asking for those laws and voting for those laws and agreeing with those laws because they're under the impression that this is how we become tough on crime. This is how we're supposed to be treating these criminals, right? And not even realizing, right, how inhumane a lot of these laws are, how inhumane a lot of these practices are, and the inhumane conditions that we're forcing people to be in. I mean, it wasn't too long ago that they were forcing women to give birth while shackled to their beds, or refusing to give women sanitary napkins during the time of their cycle. Right. I mean, and that was just straight out humane, but people were okay with it or didn't pay attention to it because who cares about what happens to the criminal? Who cares about what happened to the person that breaks the law? They're less than human, but they're only less than human until they was your relative. Mm-hmm. They're only less than human until it was you. Right. And then that's when you see a shift when people start to look at people who are incarcerated or have this interaction with law enforcement, when they start to see those people as human beings, it really helps shift the narrative and it helps really create a more humane approach to addressing our social ills.
Definitely agree with that. Thank you for that. I appreciate that. Going back into your story, you were able to turn your 15-year sentence into 3 years on your own. So can you walk us through that? And then when you were in prison, you were like the unofficial, you know, lawyer where everybody was going to you for their cases and everything. So what were you seeing at that point? And then also, like, what was that process in you turning 15 years into 3 years, which was like unheard of, you know?
Yeah, man. And listen, when I was in prison, I was like DJ Khaled, man. All I did was win, no matter what. And that's a rarity too. You know, when you talk about post-conviction motions or motions that are filed in the courts after a person is convicted, you know, it's very rare that you get positive responses, you know, from the courts. In my particular case, you know, somehow or another, I fell through the cracks. You know, typically when you go to trial, at the end of trial, if you're convicted, it triggers an automatic appeal process. And because you have a certain amount of time that you have to appeal your case. And I remember after that time elapsed, I was like, man, you know, what's going on? And come to find out that no one set the ball in motion to appeal my case. And so I had to do it myself. And so I went to the law library at the local prison where I was being held at the time. And some law clerks really helped, you know, steer me on the right path. And, it, you know, I immediately dove into this, you know. And, you know, when I was a little kid, I used to watch Perry Mason. And so as a little kid, I always had aspirations to be a lawyer or a pilot. And then even when I was locked up in the earlier years, you know, we used to watch Matlock a lot, you know. And so to be able to be in a law library, it just kind of rekindled that passion that I had for law. And I was able to actually draft a legal document or motion basically asking the courts to excuse my tardiness in filing my appeal and allow me to file a belated appeal. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's rarely granted, but however, mine was granted. And I was able to eventually get an attorney assigned from the public defender's office and you know, working with this attorney was able to get my conviction reversed and remanded. And so rather than having to do 15 years, I only did 3 years. But, you know, one of the things that stick out to me in telling this story, I mean, it really sticks out in my head, is the fact that I remember working on this young man's case along with some other law clerks. And as it turned out, this young man, he did about 17 years that he didn't even have to do.
Wow.
Right. And the thing that stuck out to me about that was the fact that, you know, a lot of us, when we get convicted or whatever, you know, when we get sentenced to prison and we go out there, we hit the yard and we like, we already get our minds right to do our time one day at a time, you know? And so while there's, you know, 300-400 people in the prison camp, sometimes even more than that in the prison camp, you know, on any given day, particularly on the weekend, when you go to the law library, it might be 8 people in there. And people were not going in the law library. They had resigned themselves to the fact that they were going to have to do their time. And, you know, what we found was that there was a lot of people that was doing unnecessary time. And this young man was one of them. 17 years he gave away because when he went, came to prison, he hit the rec yard. You know, any free time he had, he was out on, you know, if we weren't gambling, we were on the rec yard playing basketball or football or something or lifting weights on the weight pile, you know, and he did not take the time, not one bit of time to go to the library and research his case. And for 17 years, he did that. 17 years.
And I'm guessing you helped him. You helped him kind of discover his what was going on with his case.
Let me tell you something. There's some bad brothers in prison. So I can't even take half the credit for that, man. There were some bad brothers that worked in that law library. And you know, and I was just happy to play whatever little role I got to play in it. You know, there are some other cases that I did by myself. Where I was able to have some great outcomes, man. Like I said, I was like Khaled, man. All I did was anything I filed, man, came back with a positive response, you know, and was able to really, I was able to win this very intricate deportation case. I actually won the deportation case while incarcerated. Wow. Yeah. And the brother was able to not be deported and was able to get released from prison. And, you know, I don't know where he's at now, but I know one thing, that he did not get deported because of an amazing written argument that I prepared for him before the Board of Immigration Appeals.
That is amazing, man. Yeah, kudos to you, man, for doing that and helping so many people while you were locked up. And I think, like you mentioned, that there's so few people in there. But when there are people like you that people notice, they will gravitate to them and ask for help and everything, which is what was done. So afterwards, like when you get out, was it like your immediate intention to like, I've been doing this now, like I might as well go to law school. I might as well go back to school. Were you in that mindset or?
No way, Jose. Let me tell you, man, when I got out, man, I mean, law school was nowhere near my mind, you know, because I mean, at the time I was under pressure, man, that, you know, I have a felony conviction. You know, law school want me, you know, and, you know, like I said, when I got out, I really got into, actually I moved into a homeless shelter. And probably within a few weeks, I was back to abusing drugs. So I still had the drug addiction. You know, I tell folks that I was released from prison, but I was still incarcerated because of drug addiction. And, you know, I got out the winter of 2004. And, man, by August of 2005, you know, I'm standing in front of their railroad tracks, man. Waiting on that train to come, you know. During that time frame, I had already tried a previous drug treatment program. Been in a homeless shelter at least in two different occasions, you know. And you know that drug addiction really led me to those tracks in August.
What was it that kind of, you know, just turned it around for you and made you decide not to use anymore?
You know, that's a great question. You know, I don't know if I could just point to one thing that, you know, made me say I don't want to use anymore. You know, I think I've always didn't want to use. I think the problem was it was more of me that wanted to use than it were me that didn't want to use. You know, and, you know, I think at the end of the day, you know, I think part of it is me not having enough to live for, you know. And so what happened was that when I crossed those railroad tracks, you know, I wondered what would have happened if that train would have came, and if I would have died, how many people would come to my funeral. I don't know what made me think of that, man, but you know, now that's in my head, and I'm contemplating, and I'm like, okay, well, if I'm homeless and nobody know where I'm at or whatever, maybe nobody comes, right? I'll be buried in a pauper's grave. And, you know, I didn't like that. And so I said, okay, you know, I'm killed by the train, and my picture is on the front page of the local newspaper. Bold headlines, Desmond killed by train. You know, and with those headlines, started thinking about, well, who would come to my funeral? And I only came up with four people, man. And maybe out of those four, maybe two would have cried. And that was very disturbing to me, man. Like I tell folks, it really knocked the wind out of me. And I was like, wow, you mean to tell me after all these years of living, you know, on this planet and living different places in this country and having all kinds of friendships and relationships or whatever, only four people would care if you died, you know? And, you know, I asked myself, has my life been that insignificant? And, you know, I took that feeling with me into drug treatment. And I think not too long after getting there, Rosa Parks died, I seen the outpour of love at her funeral and when she laid in state in the rotunda of the Capitol. And me seeing that imagery caused me to start planning my own funeral. And in planning my own funeral, I, you know, We're going to have it at the Dolphin Stadium. As a matter of fact, I tell folks today that it's eerily similar to the memorial service that was held for Kobe and Gigi Bryant, right? That's what I was envisioning, with the only difference was that mine would be held in the football stadium, you know? And so that was, you know, that was what was in my head. But to get that many people to come to my funeral, it had me, well, how did I do that? And I landed on really using that pain and the suffering and the low self-esteem that led me to those railroad tracks, to use it in such a way that would allow people, or allow me to help people, so they don't have to go through those railroad tracks, right? And they'll be able to help other people, and so on and so on. And so that was the original motivation for helping people, was to make sure I had enough people at my funeral, since I was having it at the Dolphin Stadium, you know, and I needed to fill not only all the seats in the stadium, but I needed seats on the field too as well. I wanted standing room only, right? And so I went about that work. But not too soon after engaging in that work, which, of course, let me tell you, I didn't know what the heck I was doing. I didn't know where to start. But what I do know is that when I had an encounter that allowed me to see how I was able to impact someone's life, that encounter caused something to erupt inside of me that I had never felt before in my life. It was a joy that I never felt before. It was a joy that I didn't even know existed. It was a joy that I was chasing all of my life and didn't even know I was chasing it. Mm-hmm. Right. And at the end of the day, man, what I was able to discover was my purpose, you know, and that, you know, why am I here? You know, why am I on this planet? And why did God create me? And the answer was very simple. It was, you know, that no matter what position I was in, that there was always someone worse off than me. And my purpose was to use my life experience in such a way as to improve someone else's. Mm. And let me tell you, that feeling was so great that I, excuse the pun, but I became addicted to that. Right? Mm. I want it, man. Listen, it feels good being good, bro. You know, it's nice being nice. And so I just dove headfirst into advocacy, and knowing that, you know, praying every day that, you know, God would give me the strength, stamina, wisdom, and perseverance and discernment to do his will, to do his work. And that's all I ever wanted, was to be able to be a vessel that would be used to improve the lives of everyone.
And that is amazing, man. I'm glad things worked out like exactly that way. So afterwards, after the advocacy, man, you decide to enroll in school, and yeah, undergrad, you get like straight A's, like, you know, after being away from school for so long, man. But you had a little bit of struggle when you went on to grad school for your, for law school and everything. So can you share that with us, and then you know, some of your experiences in school?
Yeah, you know, law school, I tell folks now, man, law school is an environment, it's a beast unto its own. Mm-hmm. And if you have any kind of flaw, law school will expose that flaw in a heartbeat. And that's what it did to me, you know. You know, while I went through undergrad, you know, I did extremely well, you know, for my associates, you know, science, I graduated at the top of my class, and for my bachelor's, I graduated with highest honors. And, you know, I think there was probably only two classes where I didn't get an A. three at the most, but it's only two I can remember. And I have to say, it's part of the reason, I think, what started me on the path of just getting all these A's was I couldn't believe that they let me even go to school. You know, I'm like, man, do these people know who they got up in their school? I mean, I really, really believe that I slipped through the cracks, and that any day I was going to have a tap on my shoulder. Somebody was going to tap me on my shoulder and say, excuse me, Mr. Meade, but we made a mistake and let you in. We have to unenroll you. Mm. And so my game plan was that if I go ahead and grind now, that when they do come and get me, I'll be like, well, I know I'm not supposed to be here, but look at the good work I'm doing. You'll make an exception for me. And so that's why I was at the front. I sat at the front of the class. Man, listen, I never had me a late assignment, you know, and I made sure I banged everything out. And I was racking these A's up because I knew one day they were going to say, no, we don't accept homeless, drug addict, former prisoners in our school. You know, I had all the three major strikes against me. And so that got me on that path. But when I went to, you know, law school, man, that thing was rigorous. man, it was. And, you know, it really exposed, that the fact that I had a learning disability, you know, I would have never imagined that, man, because I banged through undergrad. No, I got 3 degrees. I got an Associate of Science, Associate of Arts, and a Bachelor of Science. You know, I there were times I was taking 6-7 classes at the same time, right? And banging up the A's out, you know, while working and while, you know, managing a 3/4 way transitional house. I mean, I was doing it. And so, couldn't tell me I was smart, wasn't smart, but I got to law school and they said, bro, you got a learning disability. They didn't discover it till after I end up getting kicked out of law school because I did not maintain a high enough GPA in my first year. But I was able to go before the academic board and they made the decision to reinstate me with the provisions that I took a special test to see if there was something wrong with me. Which I did. And then now when they discovered I had a learning disability and, you know, once that became official, you know, they made the necessary ADA requirement accommodations. Right. And once they made those accommodations, I started, guess what? Started banging the maze out in law school and ended up making the dean's list. Right. And so, yeah, that was a, that was a very trying experience, man. But, you know, listen, when I look back on it, man, I'm loving it, McKay, because it really taught me some things.
Absolutely, man. And just persevering through all that, man. I know a lot of people might have just given up after that initial experience that you had, you know, not getting your grades right the first year of law school and everything, but you persevered through and were able to, you know, to graduate. And everything. And, you know, after law school and everything, you start getting into activism. So what made you want to be an activist?
The desire to be an activist or, you know, I think was natural because of my desire to use my pain and suffering to help other people. Right. And so that was just the natural flow there. And then part of recovery is about service and giving back. And so it really, those two things really fit together very neatly. And so when I graduated from drug treatment, as I was enrolling in the local college, I was connected with multiple organizations, and one in particular was an organization called Homeless, formerly Homeless Forum, and HFHF. And I quickly joined that organization, and my affiliation with that organization led me to what was at the time just a listserv or a group of individuals and organizations that was brought together through emails to start discussions about felon disenfranchisement in Florida. And I was invited to a convening, and at that convening, I was elected to be steering committee secretary. I don't know how that worked. Cause, I mean, that was the first time I've been at this convening, and the person that nominated me didn't know me from Tom or Jane. But, you know, once again, I think that was just divine intervention. And after, you know, being nominated to be on the steering committee as a secretary, I was involved in monthly calls and taking meeting minutes and, you know, getting deeper and deeper engaged in the discussion around felon disenfranchisement. And a few years after I joined, about maybe 3 years after I joined, I was asked to step in as interim president. And man, I haven't been able to get away from them ever since. You know, in 2011, we did officially incorporate as an organization, as a state entity in Florida. And so we're now an organization. We're no longer listserv. And we've been an organization since 2011.
Right, right. And part of the work that you've done with them has been the passing of Amendment 4. So can you walk us through exactly what Amendment 4 is? And then what made you want to do the work when a lot of people failed trying to do it before? And what made you think that it could be done?
Well, probably because maybe the people that tried it before weren't directly impacted. And so, you know, at the end of the day, I didn't have no other option but to move forward. You know, at the time, Florida was one of four states that permanently disenfranchised people who convicted of felony offenses. And, you know, it was, you know, I think at the time it was like 1.54 million. In 2018, I know that number rose to 1.68 million people who were, who couldn't vote. And so, you know, the process of being able to have your rights restored, the only avenue that a person had was through the clemency process, which required that a person would petition the governor and his cabinet to give them a break. And what I seen was that, you know, you asking politicians to decide which American can vote and which American can't vote. There was something problematic with that, whether they're Democrat, Republican, or whatever. If politicians are involved in the process, then you know partisan politics are going to play a role.
Right.
And, you know, I always thought that probably voting is the most telling indicator of citizenship. And something as important as voting should not be left in the hands of any politicians. And so, you know, we eventually launched a ballot initiative that basically restores voting rights to people after they've completed their sentence. And in 2018, I mean, actually 2018, we got it placed on the ballot. And when voters came out in November of 2018 to vote for it, you know, Florida is the most difficult state to pass a ballot initiative because it requires not just a majority, but it requires a supermajority. So rather than having to get 50 plus one, you know, you had to get at least 60% of the voting population of people who voted to vote yes on that particular amendment. And right. So November of 2018, not only did we get 60, we got almost 65% of people who voted yes on Amendment 4, and we were able to successfully pass, you know, what folks arguably say is the largest expansion of voting rights for quite some time.
Yeah, that is a huge accomplishment, man. Kudos, yeah. Kudos. Yeah. What do you say to those that, you know, specifically in the Black community that might say, like, all right, Desmond, that's a great accomplishment, but why all the time and energy on voting when we got so many other problems and so many other issues? And we all know about, you know, the Electoral College vote. And, you know, what do you say to those that say, like, the vote really doesn't even matter like that? Why are you spending so much energy on this? And why not focus on other problems that we have in the Black community?
Man, it matters so much because I would say over 90% of the people who impose laws or regulation that impact us are elected. You know, at the end of the day, they're elected. You know, you got an issue with policing practices. In many cases, the sheriff is elected. If you have a police chief, he's appointed by a mayor who is elected. The person that's going to decide whether or not charges are being pressed against you is a state attorney or district attorney. they're elected. Mm. Person that you appear before of to make a determination as to your guilt, the judge is elected. You know, and so at the end of the day, there are too many people involved in your life who are impacting your life on a daily basis, who the only way they get there is by being elected. There's too many of those people around for you to be sitting around on your behind. Mm. You know, and, you know, I tell folks that, you know, to talk about whether the vote don't matter. I was telling man, hey, if your vote didn't matter, then why so many people trying so hard and using so much resources to stop you from voting?
Great point. Great point.
You know, I mean, if people are going through all kinds of stuff to prevent you from voting, there's got to be some value in that vote. And even if you don't understand that value, well, you better utilize that until you do. Mm. You know, and you just don't give it away, man, you know. And you give it away when you don't vote. You know, I know this. I mean, here in Florida, we just had, not too long ago, we had a race for Congress where the person who won the race won by 5 votes. Mm. 5 votes. I mean, we've seen, you know, our current governor, he won by 30,000 votes. And I'm telling you, we had hundreds of thousands of individuals who were registered to vote but didn't bother to even mail in a ballot. Hmm. And so our vote can make a difference.
Right.
Definitely can. But you got to put some respect on your vote.
That makes sense. That makes sense. Now, as far as...
Yeah, and then I think you also have to give some kind of respect to your ancestors, man. You know, our ancestors faced almost certain death to just go and register to vote. Right? They were hung on trees, bitten by dogs, burned alive, beaten to death, you know, sprayed with fire hoses, just to prevent them from registering to vote. And after going through that gauntlet to eventually register to vote, they was willing to go through it again to go vote. Mm. And here we are, we could mail in a ballot. You know, and I think that, you know, thinking about all of the trials and tribulations and the pain and the suffering and the loss of lives that our ancestors went through so that we can have the right to vote. For us not to vote, I think, is a slap in the face of the sacrifices that was made by our ancestors. Mm.
Interesting points. Interesting points. So as far as you yourself, afterwards, after Amendment 4 was passed, DeSantis, you know, passed certain things that kind of held a lot of returning citizens back. Even you yourself, and you went up to kind of get your rights, you know, back and to get forgiven, and you were denied twice, but eventually everything came through and passed. And now you're in a space where, you know, everything is clear. What are your plans moving forward with that?
Keep fighting for voting rights for everyone, man. You know, we made a commitment, you know, after we passed Amendment 4, that we wanted to make sure that every one of the 1.4 million people who should be benefiting from Amendment 4 have the opportunity to do so. Mm. And so that fight, that effort is long from being over. And we're just going to, you know, continue moving forward, you know, I mean. And so at the end of the day, man, I think that, you know, the more people that participate in our democracy, the more vibrant it becomes. And the more vibrant it becomes, it's better for everyone. And I just want to be a part of creating a world, man, where our governments are encouraging people to participate in our democracy. And that as a result of that, we have a vibrant democracy that's bringing in not another politician, but bringing in more and more public servants, you know, who would know their role, know their lane and stay in it and be that public servant and understand that at the end of the day, what matters most is the cries of the people and to be able to serve the people in a very honorable way. And, you know, I think a lot of that starts with getting more and more people to understand how important voting is, right? And how important it is to our democracy and to their own lives.
Right. That makes sense. So part of after, you know, Amendment 4 was passed, you got recognized by a lot of different people, and you even got recognized by Time Magazine to be, you know, top 100 most influential people in the world. And then at the end of that, you said that Time Magazine dropped the ball on that one. So I know people are like, yo, what is this guy talking about? Like, you should be appreciative. Like, what did you mean by that? And why'd you say that?
Yeah, what I meant was, that issue where they highlighted the 100 most influential people in the world, they had The Rock on that cover. I think The Rock was on one of the covers. And, you know, I told him, I said, man, y'all should have had me on the cover. That would have been the better cover. I mean, not because I look better than The Rock, you know, but the fact that I think that, you know, if they would have had me on the cover, anybody looking at that magazine or reading that magazine would know that, you know, you don't have to be a movie star. You don't have to be an athlete or billionaire or politician to have an impact in your community, in the state, in your country, or even the world, right? And having me on that cover was being able to show an example of how, you know, if that guy was homeless and addicted to crack, if he was able to turn his life around and be one of the 100 most influential in the world, then that means I can do that too. Mm. You know, that, you know, having me on the cover, I think, was a great way of empowering so many folks, right? To where they didn't have to limit themselves. They didn't have to think like I thought, you know, to have the big film. I thought I needed to be a celebrity, a movie star, or an athlete, or something like that, you know? And the reality was I did not. All I had to do was be me and do good work. You know, do God's work.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yep. Another award that you received was the MacArthur Genius Grant, which allowed you a stipend. And I don't really want to get into your business and what you're doing with that, but did you have any plans to do anything special with that stipend? And by all means, you can just do whatever you want with that.
Yeah, right? You know what? At the end of the day, you know, there was a whole lot of sacrifices that was made, you know, whole lot, physical, financial sacrifices, a whole nine yards. To really, you know, push a movement that nobody wanted pushed. You know, and it really took a lot out of me. And so one of the things is to make sure that I enjoy myself. Another thing is to figure out a way how to leverage this award in such a way that it would help me continue my work. Right. And so still working on figuring out, you know, some of these other pieces to it. But just know that those two things are going to happen. They've already started happening. I'm going to enjoy myself. And I'm going to figure out a way to leverage this, award in such a way to help me continue the work.
Yes, sir. And if you said like, yo, I'm going to go on vacation every year, like
I can do that now.
You could do that as well. Cause you, yes, I think sir. you've earned the right for that, man. So, yep. You know, it's a reason you got that, and it allows you to do whatever you want anyway. So, all right, I wanted to get into a quick activity before we wrap up, called What's Your Favorite? Identifying a few of your favorite things. Yes, sir. Of course, I got to ask you what your favorite law movie or show is.
Favorite law movie, Runaway Juror.
Runaway Juror? I don't think I've seen that.
Yeah.
All right. I gotta check that one out.
Runaway Jury. Yep.
Gotta check that out. Any reason?
It's just exciting and really just courtroom battle. It was just exciting. It really delved into a lot of the science behind picking the jury.
Gotcha. What's your favorite thing about law?
Probably the ability to argue both sides.
Got it. Favorite teacher you've ever had?
Oh, Jesus. That's a good question. Favorite teacher? That's an unfair question because well, you got high school, then you have college, you know, then you have grad. I mean, so I would say high school, Mr. Martin taught math at Miami Edison. College, Professor Cuevas, that was undergrad. And then for grad school, Professor Cleon or Professor Roman.
Anything special that they did for you, like those teachers?
I mean, it was just being them. And they were, every last one of them were individuals that challenged you to be the best you could be.
Gotcha. Yes, sir. What's been your favorite book that you've read that kind of helped with the work that you do or helped you realize some things?
The book that I read that helped me do the work that I do is probably The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander.
Ah, classic. Definitely. Man, that book is packed full of just information, statistics, just a lot of things that a lot of us didn't really know before. All right. Favorite life gem that anybody has ever given you?
My mom. It's better to be quiet and let people think you're a fool than to open your mouth and confirm it.
That does sound like something a mother would say. Man, that's funny. All right. Who are some of your favorite activists, like of all time, when you look at activists that have inspired you?
You know, I got to look at, you know, the biggest movements around voting expansion over the last 4 to 6 years have been led by people who've been directly impacted. Right. So you talk about people who are like doing bang up jobs and really a source of inspiration. You talk about people like Dorsey Nunn and Dara Atkinson and Susan Burton and Norris Henderson. You know, you got Tara Simmons that went from being a drug addict to now a state legislator. You know, got my brother Jerome Betts and that went from being incarcerated to being a poet, lawyer, professor, and a fellow, MacArthur Genius Fellow. You know, there's just Marcus Bullock, you know, doing some amazing work with his flick shop work. And then, of course, there's other activists out there, but just really wanted, to really highlight the people who directly impacted, man, that's doing amazing work in this country. Mm-hmm. And I know I left out a ton of folks, but, you know, at the end of the day, they know it.
Got it. Part of your work, too, man, you've been able to meet quite a number of celebrities that have kind of taken to your work and helped out. So who's been
John Legend? My favorite John Legend. Point blank.
Why John Legend?
Because, I mean, dude is just amazing. Amazing, awesome, real. I mean, on a scale from 1 to 10, he at 12, man. You know, he really believe in elevating the voices of people who directly impacted. And he's really a good ally and a good advocate. Now, he's the Harry Belafonte of our time.
That's high regard right there. Yep. That's high regard. I've seen him be a major part of the work that you do. You guys have done interviews together. Mm-hmm. He's donated towards your funds, and has helped with charity work and everything. So seems to definitely be one of the believers in your message and what you're doing.
Most definitely.
All right. What's your favorite thing about the Virgin Islands?
The water. Yeah.
Yeah, the islands, man. You can't beat the water, man. Just clear and warm and nice. Yeah, definitely. All right. Your favorite thing to do to relax and kind of get away from everything?
Barbecuing,
okay.
Yeah, love to get on that grill.
What you be throwing on the grill?
Nothing but beef, protein, and ribs and steaks and chicken. The meats guy.
Gotcha. Yep. So you season everything yourself and
do all that. I'm a grill master, man.
That's dope, man. Maybe next time I'm in Florida, man, I might have to.
Yeah, you might have to stand in line, man. There's a long list of people that's trying to get there, man. Trying to get some of this famous barbecue. Real, man. It's real.
Gotcha. All right. So going back into your work, man, I know you're continuing to fight for a lot of different things as it relates to returning citizens and voting and everything. But if we can just reimagine like an actual justice system, in the way that it's supposed to be, what kind of picture would you paint in regards to an actual system that treats everyone equally and does what it's supposed to do?
Well, I think it's a system that responds to mistakes, or responds to people who make mistakes with love instead of anger or hatred.
Well said. All right. As far as you go, man, when the documentary comes out of your work and everything that you've done, what are some things that you want to make sure is included in that legacy piece? And what do you want us to know about everything in regards to the work that you've done?
The power of love. At the end of the day, okay. The power of love. And that we can accomplish more with love than we can with hate, and violence and fear and all that, I think that love is the ultimate neutralizer. It's probably the most powerful force. It's out there, and it's just so much upside to operating under the sphere of love.
Man, it has been quite a journey listening to your work and everything that you've done, man. I feel really inspired, especially looking back.
Thank you so much, man.
Hey, thank you, man. Just looking back at where you started to where you are now, man, I think that it just inspires millions of people to kind of, go after what they want. And, sometimes we have that fear of being an activist and doing things. And I also wanted to ask you that as well. Like, as far as activism goes, what do you say to those that want to make change and do things? And we get that fear that, nothing's going to change, or, I might get arrested, I might get killed, something might happen where, this is not worth doing, I might lose my family, whatever it is. So what do you say to people that have that desire to make a change, but fear as well in regards to activism?
Don't do it. Don't do it, man. At the end of the day, though, for real, this work is not easy work. And you get out of it what you put into it. And so, you can't bring a six pack of Budweiser to the party, but want to drink up all the Chevys in the Remy Martin. You just can't do that. You can't bring a pack of Publix donuts to the cookout, but want to walk away with four plates of ribs and chicken and ribeye steak. So you have to be willing to put into something what you want out of it. And so I tell folks that really, really find what their passion is, right? Something that they're willing to fight for, something that they're willing to die for, right? And that's where they focus their attention. And then at the same time, making sure that the things that you're trying to do is not motivated by some selfish reason, but rather it's motivated by a love of others. Right. And if you can put those two pieces together, I think that you will find success along the way, and success looks different. Success is not, you could be successful without winning. Right. I think that what's more important than anything, than any personal accolades that you can get, is knowing the fact that you've impacted someone's life. And I'll be honest with you, man. What I've discovered is that if you could impact one life, you met your quota.
Hmm.
Everything you went through in life became worthwhile when it was used to impact just one life. And the reason why I say that, because it don't stop at that one, right? Adam and Eve are one and one. And now you have billions and billions and billions and billions, right? And so I've lived long enough to see how people, the work that we do, impact generations, right? You able to help restore hope to a returning citizen who's able to get a job and housing and be able to participate in our democracy and find their place in society, and that translates to his children, right? And that translates to his children's children, you know, and we see that. We've seen the impact of it and how it inspires not only that person's child, but that person's relative or other people in that particular person's sphere of influence, right? And you'll see so many great things come out of it from so many different angles that exponentially increases, right, from just impacting one life. And so I think that, you know, like I said, if you find a passion and you lead with love and understand that, man, you can meet your quota with why.
Yes, sir. Yeah. Appreciate that. Yep. If you could do us one more favor and leave us with your favorite quote and what it means to you, we greatly appreciate that.
Wow. We, the willing, led by the unknown, is doing the impossible for the ungrateful. We've done so much for so long with so little, we're not qualified to do anything with nothing. Those of us who've had obstacles in our lives and seemingly unsurmountable challenges, and so those of us who've made missteps along the way, you know, that saying basically says that in spite of all of that, we have the ability to overcome and achieve and do great things, right? And that the only thing that stops us is ourselves. Hmm. But we have the ability to go as high as we want to go. Once again, if we're committed to leading with love and doing for others.
Yes, sir. Well said, man. Again, I'm super inspired right now. I know those of us listening might want to know where to find you, where to find your work, and where to even, I know you help, you know, formerly incarcerated or returning citizens that are not sure whether they have the right to vote in Florida and things like that. So where can people kind of hit you up for questions? Or
yes, they could go to our website at www.floridarrc.com, floridarrc.com. And then for folks who need help with fines and fees, if you're living in the state of Florida and you have a family member, friend that need help finding out whether or not they owe anything, and if they do owe, then you may need help in taking care of those legal financial obligations, they can call 1-877-MY-VOTE-0, 1-877-MY-VOTE-0.
There it is, Mr. Mead. Again, I appreciate you greatly, man. I'm sure you will do a ton more work, and we probably will have to have you back on the program at some point. So appreciate your time. I know you're super busy, but you know, you put out time to speak with us today, so we appreciate that.
Most definitely, most definitely. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Right. Listeners, please share the program. A lot of us are not 100% on some of the rights that we have, things that are going on in Florida. And obviously, Mr. Desmond Mead and his story, you know, if you're not inspired, I don't know what to tell you, because this dude came from the streets of Florida, being homeless, being addicted to drugs. And now, you know, being able to do the work that he's done is amazing and inspiring, and just gives us energy that we can do whatever it is that we put our minds to.
Yep.
And we should all have that in our heads. And of course, remember, your mind is the most powerful tool in the universe. Therefore, if you can think it, you can do it. If you believe in it, you can be it. And if you fight for it, you can have it. The world is yours. This has been your host, Mr. G, and I'll see you next time on Mastermind.